Audio version of Michael Leitman's blog. November 27, 2020. The infinity of the Creator and His creation. The Creator made the desire of the creatures small, like the Malkut of the world of infinity. Infinity meant that the desire was completely filled, that is, without boundaries, like a full glass. But then this desire must develop to infinite proportions. Due to the fact that the Creator created the creation, the desire to enjoy, the opposite of Himself, this gives us the opportunity to reveal the Creator without any boundaries and restrictions, without any stopping on the way until the end of correction and after it. When we finish all the corrections, covering the whole desire to enjoy with the intention to bestow, then further progress will continue in other forms, no longer due to lack. However, the endless movement forward will continue anyway because this is the only way to reveal the infinity of the Creator. From the third part of the Daily Kabbalah lesson, November 18, 2020, Connecting the World in the Last Generation. Michael Leitman, on the Times of Israel, Why I Care, and Write, About the World. Recently, I have received some questions about my interest in worldly matters. These readers seem to believe that Kabbalists should take no interest in the material world and current affairs. However, nothing could be further from the truth. Kabbalists care a great deal about the world, and for very good reasons. But before I elaborate on the reasons for writing and speaking about the world we live in, it is important to realize that in doing so, I am in no way the first. Great sages throughout the centuries were very interested in the events of their time. They often wrote about it, too. In the 20th century alone, two spiritual giants expressed themselves on various occasions regarding the world around them. When the great Rav Kook saw that the Jews were in danger abroad, he wrote a plea for their arrival at the land of Israel. In a declaration published in the book Essays of the Re'ia, he asked them, "Assemble one by one, wait not for formal words and orders, wait not for permits from renowned ones. Do what you can, flee and gather." After a few more sentences, he adds, "Amalek, Petliura, anti-Semitic Ukrainian leader, Hitler, and so forth, awaken for redemption." One who did not hear the call, for his ears were blocked, will hear against his will. A contemporary of Rav Kook, the great Rav Yehuda Ashlag, known as Baal HaSulam for his Sulam, Ladder, commentary on the Book of Zohar, and the father of my teacher, Rav Baruch Ashlag, Rabash wrote in great detail about current affairs. His essays The Peace and Peace in the World, and his extensive composition The Writings of the Last Generation are some of the publications where he expressed his views on current affairs and politics, both in Israel and around the world. But Baal HaSulam worked tirelessly to circulate his ideas, and mainly his warnings. He published a newspaper titled The Nation, in which he dealt only with current affairs, and predicted the outcome of Israel's conflicts with the Arabs, and much more. In the piece, Baal HaSulam analyzes Russian communism and predicts its downfall. Even though he wrote the article in 1932, he was already convinced of Russia's ultimate collapse. In his words, "Go and see what has become of Russia, instead of rising and exceeding the achievements of the capitalist countries, they have sunk ever lower." Note that in 1932, he already wrote in past tense, as though it was a done deal. Now, he continues, "They not only fail to benefit the lives of the workers a little more than in the capitalist countries, they cannot even secure their daily bread and clothes on their flesh." Later in the essay, Baal HaSulam explains that this has happened to them because they failed to educate their people about the importance of unity and solidarity. Baal HaSulam does not stop his explanation with Russia. In the Writings of the Last Generation, written shortly after World War II, he explains once more why communism did not succeed, and what will follow it, Soviet Russia has already proven that an insufficiently developed society will invert the cooperative governance into the worst governance in the world. Moreover, Marx assumed that the subsequent phase to the ruin of today's capitalistic democratic governance is the governance of the workers, but reality has shown, perhaps a reference to Marx, that the subsequent governance to today's governance is the Nazi or fascistic governance. We might think that this was a slip of the pen, so to speak, but Balhaas Sulam makes his point very clear. In his writings, he mentions the word Nazi, Nazis, or Nazism 27 times, and the word fascist or fascism 11 times. In the excerpt below, he warns that the Nazi regime is likely to emerge from the left rather than from the right. We should also take into account that all those who are ruining the natural process of the just governance actually came from the proletariat and emerged from their midst, and not necessarily the Soviets, but the majority of Nazis were also initially pure socialists, as well as the majority of fascists. Even Mussolini himself was initially an enthusiastic socialist leader. Further below, Balhaas Sulam returns to Marx and writes about the danger of Nazism emerging specifically in democratic, capitalistic countries. Marx thought that the subsequent stage to the bourgeois, capitalistic regime would be a cooperative workers' regime, but in the end, we are living witnesses that if the democratic bourgeois government were to be ruined now, a Nazi and fascist regime would promptly rise in its stead. Worse yet, whenever the democratic government is ruined, a fascist, Nazi regime will inherit it. Balhaas Sulam did not settle for writing about his predictions. He participated physically in political assemblies and parades in Poland before he moved to the land of Israel. Here, he met with political and social leaders and tried to convince them to include education toward unity in their platforms, speeches, and writings. He met with David Ben-Gurion, the first Prime Minister of Israel, Zalman Shazar, the third President of Israel, Moshe Sheret, the second Prime Minister of Israel, Haim Alosroff, head of the political department of the Jewish Agency, renowned poet Haim Naaman Bialik, and many others. In all those meetings, he strove to promote the agenda of unity above differences. Regrettably, they would not listen, and today we are faced with the consequences. My teacher, Rabash, Balhaas Sulam's firstborn son and successor, spoke to me at great length about current affairs and where they would develop. He knew that I would continue his path and the path of his father. We had talked about it many times, and it is my commitment to him and to Balhaas Sulam to carry on with my efforts to warn humanity about the approaching cataclysm. We need to understand that a Kabbalist relates to the world in a very different way than other people. A Kabbalist's one and only goal is to help everyone develop the quality of love of others. Kabbalists strive for connection above all the differences, knowing full well that these differences all come from the singular, benevolent force that has created the world, and are implanted in the world precisely so that we will be able to develop the quality of love of others to counter the natural rejection we feel toward those who oppose our views. Were it not for the existence of opposers, we would not feel hate and would therefore have no impetus to develop love in order to counter it. It turns out that even those we hate, the Creator, the force of love and giving, put them there in order to help us grow and become loving individuals. The countless conflicts in our world are opportunities to bridge hatred by building love between us. This is why these conflicts occur in the first place. If we acknowledge this and work on building love, our bonding strengthens and our society thrives. If we do not seize the moment and succumb to our hatred, the force of giving will have to give us even greater hatred in order to compel us to build love above it. It turns out that the more we avoid our work, the more we bring upon ourselves increasing pain and hardships. We need to understand that spirituality means giving love. It is not some parallel universe or an elevated state of consciousness where you become aloof and indifferent to material life. On the contrary, spirituality is an approach to life in this world that changes our perception of it. A Kabbalist's task is therefore to help all people see the force of giving acting behind everything that happens, and help them connect with it. A Kabbalist must take interest and write about current affairs as a means to explain the operations of the giving force, the Creator, and advise people how to direct their lives, establish their own connections with the Creator, and achieve happiness and confidence in life. When Kabbalists observe the world, they look for the easiest, quickest, and most pleasant ways for people to achieve the positive transformation that they want to advance. If this way requires support for a certain political entity or direction, they will support it. They have no personal benefits to gain as a result of their support, or any other ulterior motive. Their only motivation for supporting any entity or organization, political or not, is the advancement of humanity toward connection, mutual responsibility, and solidarity. Kabbalists will support anyone who champions it, and oppose anyone who hinders it. Because Kabbalists want everyone to be connected and acquire the quality of love, they care about the entire world, all the people, animals, plants, and planets. Rav Kook once said to the renowned author Alexander Zishkin Drabinovitz, "Hazar, I wish the whole of humanity could be placed into a single body, so I could embrace them all." This is the attitude of a true Kabbalist. Thrive Global published my new article, Jerusalem, the Heart of the World. We discover a fresh new purpose to our lives as we come closer to each other in our thoughts and feelings of mutual care and empathy. We align ourselves with the perfect global interconnectedness and reciprocity existing in nature. The pandemic's determination and tenacity to continue its global spread has created a numbness and dulled us to sleep. A general fatigue has expanded throughout humanity, so the urge to find any source of contentment is only natural. Recently, a song in the Zulu language came along with a message of hope, Jerusalem, which transformed into a collective dance that has taken the world by storm. Its wildfire spread shows how eager people are to connect. Now the question is, how can that feeling of connection be elevated to a higher level of unity, one that surpasses our physical actions and the distances between us, to give lasting joy? Jerusalem is the heart, the center of the world, the epicenter of all desires and aspirations, a state in which everything is based on mutual love for one another. When we reach such a state through the connection of our hearts, we will not only activate new sensations of livelihood, high spirits and energy, we will also attain boundless and eternal joy. Michael Leitman. Some of my students asked me about the global sensation Jerusalem, explaining that the South African theme became a lockdown anthem as group dances spread in every part of the planet to uplift the spirit during COVID-19 restrictions. My response is that dancing, especially in a group, is a positive activity as it gives a sense of togetherness. At the same time, humanity's state of desperation will still be waiting to resurface as soon as the contagious beats die down and everyone returns to his own place and concerns about the uncertain future. In other words, a group activity for entertainment will act as a sort of therapy and escape from reality, but it won't allow us to close our eyes like scared children without sharpening our minds with meaningful questions about what the tiny virus is trying to teach us. The pandemic calls for a deeper scrutiny of the state of the world, what we have wrongly built until now, and what needs to be flipped for humanity's betterment. That the virus is stirring up the need for connection between us, toward the goal of a better life. Interestingly, the song's theme of Jerusalem as home, as a special place in life, can be explained with a profound perspective from the wisdom of Kabbalah. In the Ari's book The Tree of Life, it is written that if a person reaches the revelation of the upper force through the right attitudes of love and bestowal toward others, he discovers a special quality called Jerusalem, which refers not to a physical place but to a state of perfect unity. Therefore, today's Jerusalem, which is a holy city for the three major world religions, is not the real Jerusalem written about by prophets and sages. Jerusalem, Yerushalayim, represents the perfect city, Arishlama, in which we all achieve perfection in the relationships between us, complementing each other. We discover a fresh new purpose to our lives as we come closer to each other in our thoughts and feelings of mutual care and empathy. We align ourselves with the perfect global interconnectedness and reciprocity existing in nature. Jerusalem is the heart, the center of the world, the epicenter of all desires and aspirations, a state in which everything is based on mutual love for one another. When we reach such a state through the connection of our hearts, we will not only activate new sensations of livelihood, high spirits and energy, we will also attain boundless and eternal joy. Published on November 26, 2020. Michael Leitman, on Quora, What is freedom of speech and what are the limits of free speech? Freedom of speech and freedom of expression definitely require limits. The first limit is that we should not hurt or offend anyone. Causing no harm to others should act as an inbuilt constitution that first and foremost determines the limits of our free speech. It is similar to how we consider it a criminal offense to break into another person's home and cause damage to its property. Suppose I have a neighbor whose father passed away, and I start making fun of his father. It would be disgraceful and disrespectful to my neighbor, and I would awaken hatred by doing so. How could I let myself do that? It is completely irrational. If we want to hurt and offend others, then it is precisely these desires that require correction. Their correction initially needs a restriction of their outward manifestation. Afterward, we need to bring ourselves to a state where we hold nothing against anyone in the world other than our own self, and we can then truly be considered free. In short, we can be free in every aspect of life on condition that we each refrain from harming each other. In such a state, we can have criticism, disagreements and arguments, but we would need to learn how to not awaken hatred in each other while doing so. We would therefore need to regularly engage in connection-enriching learning, to elevate our sensitivity, empathy and inner intelligence so that our common goal to live harmoniously, peacefully and happily with each other would envelop all of our thoughts and aspirations. In short, we cannot let ourselves hurt each other. On the contrary, we have to respect each other. We each feel different ideas, people and objects in differing levels of importance according to where, to whom, and how we were born and raised. One person considers something to be very important, and another person considers something else to be very important. However, above what we each consider as important, we should try to see what we all have in common. New Life 449. The Phenomenon of Emigrants from Israel, Part 1.
Hello and thanks for being with us here on the New Life Show, a series of talks with Dr. Michael Leitman. Hello, Dr. Leitman. Hello, everyone. Hello, Yael Eshedael. Hello. Our subject today is stirring up emotions here in Israel. Many people are migrating from Israel. Many people want to leave the country. And we'd like to understand, where does this phenomenon come from and what can we do about it? Yael, please. Yeah. There are growing numbers of people, especially young people, and this is something that's been going on for a long time. People that are leaving Israel, people that think that abroad their life will be better. They're despaired of the economical situation, security issues, the constant pressure that we're living under, missiles flying over your head every now and then, terror attacks. And they decide that they want to leave Israel. It's a global world. It's very common to move from one country to another. And we're talking about a third of the younger population. that served in the army, that see themselves as Zionists, that this country is really important for them, and they want to leave. And they have a very strong conflict. On the one hand, in terms of quality of life, the tranquility that you can find abroad. But on the other hand, people really love this country. And when you live abroad, you always miss home. So it's a non-simple decision. And these are people that really, really love their country. So we're asking, maybe something's working incorrectly. Maybe there's a phenomenon that we should start looking at as a society and try and understand what's going on. So these are the things that we'd like to scrutinize on this show. We're not criticizing anyone, but we really want to look at this phenomenon, investigate it, understand it, and see what's the right thing to do. And how should we live our life here so maybe it won't happen? And I'd like to open with a question. Like we said, we're living in a global world where it's very common to move from country to country. And is it really so important for us as Israelis to live in the country that we were born in? Or is it okay to move to any other country? It depends on how we perceive our existence altogether. We're in exile. And when we're in exile, we're in exile. The Israelis that are moving? No, in general. Right now, we are in exile. It doesn't matter where we're living. Whether geographically we're living in the land of Israel, within the borders of the land of Israel, as it used to be, as is written in the Torah, or we're in the United States, in Russia, in Europe, in any other place. One way or another, we're in exile. In exile from the concept of the land of Israel and the people of Israel. The people of Israel. It means the people that are connected between them by the laws of love, as were taught to them by Abraham, our patriarch. He is the father of the nation. He arranged this. Avraham in Hebrew also means Avraham, the father of the nation. And the land of Israel, it's the soil or the land, if we can call it that. These are the borders in our world in relation to the spiritual world where the people of Israel have to exist according to the root and branch. According to the spiritual root, the people of Israel have to exist within these borders in the corporeal branch. This is where Moses brought them to. And what does it mean to us today? Wait a moment. This is a different question. Why are you rushing? I'm still explaining the definitions. So I want to understand, exile means disconnection? Disconnection from the concept of the people of Israel and the concept of the land of Israel and the concept of the people of Israel and the land of Israel. So, can you define each of these? The people of Israel is that group that Abraham, our patriarch, connected from all those different people that came to him, that were very far from each other, who came from the different tribes that existed back then in ancient Babylon, and he connected them all under love another as thyself. Abraham is chesed, mercy. He taught them how to be in mercy toward each other, and by that they connected and reached brotherly love, connection. And actually regarding each other, they were strangers. They didn't come from the same mothers, they weren't cousins, but they even came from different tribes, like all of Babylon, that consisted of different small nations. This is the entire civilization, the Babylonian civilization of back then. And Abraham connected them. How? That love covers for all crimes, for all their differences, meaning that they rise above everything, and they start connecting. This is what he did with them. So this is the definition of the people of Israel. Yes. a relationship of mercy and love among strangers. Yeah, that people that to begin with are strangers, but they don't look at that. They look at how can they be connected between them by ties of love. Why? Because the upper force of nature is the force of love. And they want to match this force. They want to be like him. And therefore, they're called Bnei Adam. In Hebrew, both meaning man, but also meaning to be similar to the Creator. And therefore, you're called Adam, meaning man. Those that are similar to the Creator, and not the nations of the world, because they're not similar to the Creator. And therefore, as it says, they're not called man, but they're all deemed as beasts. And this is something that you have to understand. What does it really mean? It's not in order to despise anyone, but these are facts. This is how the degrees in mankind are structured. So this is the definition of who the people of Israel are: strangers that build a relationship of mercy and love between them up to the degree of brotherly love, and such a relationship between people is the definition of what it means to be the people of Israel. No, it's not enough. That's only half. The other half is why. In order to become like the people of Israel, which literally means to be aimed straight at the Creator, at the upper force. Isra means straight, and El means the upper force, the Creator, in order to aim themselves directly at, to directly reach the upper force, to match him, to become like him, to achieve adhesion with him, to be like that force of love that you talked about before. Yes, which is the general force of nature, that's called the upper force or Creator. So the sum total of all of this means to be the people of Israel. Yes. And when you said that today we're in exile from the concept of the people of Israel, then I understand that today we don't have such a relationship, and therefore our relationships today here in the land of Israel don't fit the definition of what it means to be the people of Israel. And therefore, we're not the people of Israel. In spirituality, if you're in equivalence of form with something, this is what you are. If you're not, then you're not. It's not according to my grandma or my ID card, my passport, but according to my inner traits, qualities. Am I in them or not? Yesterday, I could be a complete Gentile, and today, I'm Israel, I'm a Jew. But if I'm not united with others, if I'm not Yashar Kel, aimed straight at the upper force, then I'm not Israel and I'm not a Jew. Now, you also said that the land of Israel is a certain concept that we're not a part of. What is that? Eretz, land, from the word Ratzon in Hebrew, desire. Meaning those individuals that unite and achieve connection amongst them, they have a special force called a mutual desire. That mutual desire in our world, on the inanimate level, on the earthly level, is related to a certain area, matches a certain area, place on earth, called the land of Israel. And this is the place where Moses and later on Joshua brought that group that was founded by Abraham back in Babylon. Even though that it happened 1500 years later, but this is what happened. So again, can you please define the concept of what does it mean, Eretz Yisrael, the land of Israel? The land of Israel, in Hebrew, Eretz Yisrael, is the desire to be aimed straight at the Creator. Eretz, land, means desire. Isra, or Yashar, means straight at. Kel, the Creator, the desire by which you reach the Creator. What is this desire? It's the desire for connection, to connect among them, to reach adhesion with the Creator, equivalence of form with them. So, a desire is something internal, right, inside the person. Right. But, when we realize this desire among us, we're also physically drawn to be in a certain place on earth. And that place is called the land of Israel. So there are two levels here, actually. Right. But just a minute. And those who have this kind of connection with other people, that they belong to the people of Israel, feels a certain inclination toward this place It means that he wants to return to or be in the land of Israel. Therefore, also Balusulam writes about it, that whoever has an inclination toward internality, spirituality, he feels an inclination toward the land of Israel. So, a common desire for what? This I don't understand yet. For our connection, for the connection between us, that as a result of our connection, we'll achieve connection with the Creator. So, a mutual desire for connection among people, where inside this connection they will attain connection with upper force? What does that have to do with the land of Israel, which is a geographical place? They feel inclination towards coming to this place, to this land. Yes. So, from this, we can understand who are those that immigrate from Israel, that people who completely lose connection, sensitivity, some kind of inner feeling, inner desire to be connected between them in order to attain the Creator, even though that they don't have it in mind, they don't understand this, they're simple people, but they don't have it. This light does not shine for them. They have no impression, excitement from it. They feel that if so, it's better to live in the United States. They're not excited by what? By the connection between Jews, to be as one nation in the land of Israel. The importance of it decreases compared with getting better along and being better off in some foreign land. I don't exactly understand. The importance of what decreases? The importance of the connection of being together in the land of Israel. And then a person immigrates from Israel. Yes, I think that's obvious. Or, if it's obvious, why did you ask twice? Because you're emphasizing as if there was something, and gradually it disappears until a person no longer feels it, and I don't see that the rest of the people that live here today in Israel and didn't immigrate to Berlin or someplace, live in brotherly love in order to be like the upper force or something. You described some kind of reduction in what a person feels, and as a result, he leaves because he doesn't feel any connection to this place anymore. So I'm asking, what is that thing that a person had and lost? Because I don't see that the rest of the public that don't leave, that stay here, have it. I remember different times when I was denied permission to immigrate to Israel for 4 years, and how many struggles, and how much health it cost me, and frustration, until finally I managed to get here. I invested 7 or 8 years into it, until I got here. 4 years out of which I was denied permission to immigrate to Israel. And it was important for me. And besides me, there were many others. I read about the first immigration, the first Aliyah, the second Aliyah, the second immigration after World War II, how Jews came here. There were different times, and then it evoked a desire in you to come here to Israel. When? Before you came to Israel, back in those years where you were a refusenik, it created a desire in you to come to Israel. Because I wanted to come here, I was denied permission to immigrate. It was a desire for what? I don't know. It was a desire to be independent, not under some foreign rule, to be equal to others, to be proud of my people, of my country, of everything that I am. I want to be like others, without religion, without upper force, without anything. But simply, there was this inner feeling, I have to be here. Why? Because my people are here, this is my country, this is my place on earth. Many of the immigrants that came from Eastern Europe to Israel, they migrated back. Why? They maybe had a different calculation. or when they came and saw the ideals that exist here, they couldn't stand them. What ideals did they aspire for that they couldn't find here? I remember myself too, when I came to the land of Israel, and I saw the corruption and theft that's going on here, and politics and everything. The hatred between the Moroccans and the Ashkenazians and the Polish and the Iraqis and so on. And everyone's making fun of each other on TV. There were only two channels back then, I think, on television altogether. And this is what all the shows were about. Making fun of the Yemenians, making fun of the Polish people. I looked at it, I didn't understand, what is there to laugh about? Why is the very precious time of television broadcast filled with that? Why are they making an issue out of it? Can't you find anything more beneficial to explain, to talk, to tell about something, sing about something, act out more inner, internal things, but not disregard? Even if this disregard comes from love, still it's disregard. It teaches a person how to act. It teaches people how to disregard others, his own people, regardless what parts they came from now. And I remember the way I looked at it, and many of my friends that more or less came in the same year as I did, it's around the time of the Yom Kippur War, they left later. I later met them in Europe and in the United States. How do you see these things? Is it important for Jews, for Israelis to stay and live in Israel, or it's not that important? I'm just saying that for those people that came here, like you said, that there is an opposite phenomenon. I understand it, because they thought that it's possible to build the people of Israel in the land of Israel here. It's like when you're abroad and you feel as if you're handcuffed. You're in a state where you're disregarded and you're considered second and third class. And when you reach your place where you can be strong together with everyone as one people, one country and so on, and when you get there you see that it was as if all you were made fun of, that your entire dream was turned into garbage or something, and you're even more offended, so much so that you can't stand the state that's going on here. I remember I had this kind of feeling, but I left it aside. On purpose, I went to work in the Air Force. I went to, as if, live among soldiers, even though that I was already 27, 28. I went to be in such a place where I won't see what's going on the street and politics and everything, but to be next to the youngsters in the army, I found my place there. Otherwise, I couldn't stand it. Maybe I'd also leave the country. Okay, so let's take a broader look at this phenomenon, and leaving aside the public that we talked about previously that immigrated to Israel and then left. There's the land of Israel, and there are more and more people that are leaving Israel. Looking more broadly at the phenomenon, is it important for Israelis to live in Israel, yes or no, and if yes, then why? The way I see it? Yeah. Of course, it's important that the people of Israel will live in the land of Israel, but as something sustainable. Right now, what's called the people of Israel can't live in what seems now as the land of Israel. Because we, for some reason, forget that the people of Israel It's a very special spiritual concept, and the land of Israel is a spiritual concept. And it's impossible for us to relate to the land of Israel or to the people of Israel and corporeal standards. It won't work. I can't just gather Jews and say, this is the people of Israel. And there's no relation between them, like Abraham, our patriarch, determined that this is how it has to be between people. I can't bring this mixed multitude to a place and say, okay, these are the people of Israel, and they live within the boundaries of the land of Israel. Why? Because it says from Dan to Beersheba and so on, so it's fine that they're here. These are the borders, this is the land of Israel, because the concept of Israel does not exist. The land of Israel is the mutual desire of people to be directed at Yashar Kel, straight at the upper force. Eretz, land, meaning desire, and Yashar Kel, straight at the upper force. If there's no such thing, then there's no Israel and no land of Israel. We're not like other nations. Other nations, it's like we see, the people of Israel is not a people. It's not a nation. It's not the nation of Israel. It's really the remnants of different tribes, parts of tribes, different individuals that came to Abraham, and Abraham turned them into a special people. Special how? In their connection. There has to be a spiritual connection between them of love, above the corporeal rejection. There has to be love, and then that's called the people of Israel, being as one man and one heart. Don't do to others what you hate. Love another as thyself. All of Israel are friends, united and mutual guarantee. And then this way, this group, they exist and they're called people. And therefore today, we're not a people. And also the borders that we live in. Therefore there's no inclination toward the land of Israel, this desire that is felt from the ground, that it's coming from the ground, these special kinds of forces. We don't feel them because we're not the people of Israel, and therefore we have no connection to the land of Israel, that we feel that this is our land. No, but to the contrary, because we disrespect the concept of the people of Israel as a single connection. We don't feel the forces from this place, which is the land of Israel, that it belongs to us. But the Arabs, they're right. They say, this is our land. They feel a stronger inclination toward this land than we do. I'm sure of it. I see it. I saw it and heard about it many times. What do you see? That an Arab, when he takes this soil, it's just sand. What is there about it? He says, this is mine. This is what he feels. And we. And therefore they deserve being here and we don't. Why don't we feel it? Because we're not united. According to the concept of the people of Israel, we're not united? No. What's the connection between our unity and feeling that there's a special force in the soil? We don't have the feeling that from this land comes a force that's in correlation with our connection. Land means desire, ratzon, a desire to be aimed straight at the Creator. We don't have that desire because we're not united, and therefore we don't feel that this land belongs to us. Can you put this in simple words? Why does an Arab feel the force coming from this land and we don't? I'll try. If we connect between us as one man and one heart, between us there is a single force generated. And this force is toward the upper force, toward the Creator, toward this unity that exists in nature. If so, we have a special sense, the sense to feel as one, to feel love, connection, the Creator. And then we would feel that in this soil, in this land, there is this special force that belongs to us. Once I read this letter where one Kabbalist who lived here in Israel wrote to a friend of his, and his friend answers, half of the letter you wrote when you were in the land of Israel, and half of the letter where you were outside of the land of Israel. Where were you? And he answers, it's true. I went out to the city of Akko. So much so, through the letter, they felt, where is the person that's writing it? On what part of earth he is? Because it's all one force that works this way. This is spiritual geography, and we don't feel it. But I'm telling you that without these concepts, without bringing them a bit closer to ourselves, we won't be able to understand what the problem is, and there's no point in talking about immigrating from or to, all these things. What does it really matter to a person where to live then? Our time for this talk is almost up. How would you summarize what we talked about regarding immigrating from Israel? It's not immigrating from or to. People don't feel neither this nor that. We just call it that way. The same way they were brought up here, with the same attitude they had toward the land of Israel, the state of Israel, the people of Israel. They keep living there. They don't feel that they lost anything. I saw them, I met them. No, they don't feel anything. The main thing, things are calmer, better. Look at the houses that we have. Look how cheap everything is. We have security, we feel safe. Everything's fine. I don't need anything. For me, this is the land of Israel. Where? I'll tell you where I met them. In completely remote places, in Southern California and other places, the main thing is that everything's fine, that we're well off. So I'll summarize what I understand. Until here in Israel, we change our perception of what the people of Israel and the land of Israel are, and we'll start coming closer to being a society where there's brotherly love, where there's love in others thyself. Until then, things will only get worse here. I'd put it this way. Unless we make a spiritual revolution here in the land of Israel, we, meaning our organization, then the entire, let's call it, Zionistic enterprise that we have witnessed in the 20th century is going to come to an end. Our time's up. Thank you very much, Dr. Lightman. Thank you, Gael. Thank you for being with us. There are many things to think about. Until next time, all the best.
Uniting for the sake of uniting. Question. There is a law that a person in a crowd falls under its influence. He begins to lose control of himself and can easily lose his eye. But why, when I am in a group of people who want to unite and reach a new level of attainment, this law doesn't seem to apply? Answer. Because egoism does not push you to unite, you must act against it. And you enter the crowd with your egoism and realize it like everyone else. It's very simple, very easy. Any person who joins a crowd becomes like it. He finds justification for his egoism, feels big, great, like the crowd. It is very difficult, almost impossible, to be in a crowd and not obey it. Comment. But I spend a lot of time among people who want to unite for the sake of unity. And they don't influence me. My response, this isn't a crowd. The crowd is an egoistic rabble who decides to combine their individual egoistic impulses for some even greater gain. And so it goes, breaks, hits, and rampages. It affects your egoism, and you start acting like them. The crowd drags you along. And when you want to unite for the sake of unity, it's a completely different matter. You are part of a group that works to rise above its ego, to annul it, to deny its animal nature. There is a lot of work going on here. An outsider won't even know what you're doing. From CAB TV's Communication Skills, September 25th, 2020. The meaning of life is here and now. Question. Many different schools of self-improvement offer such concepts as living consciously, living in the present moment. They promise that this state will allow you to enjoy life, feel it more, and manage it. How does one live exactly here and now? Answer. Begin to comprehend the meaning of life here and now. Nothing else is needed. I want to comprehend the meaning of my existence, the connection with an upper force that controls me. And we are governed by nature, it is the highest power. Let's comprehend what it requires of us, at every moment of time, how we can be with it in mutual connection, in such communication so that I understand how nature affects me and how I should react to it correctly. Then my life will be full of meaning. In nature I will find a partner and begin to feel my interaction with the outside world here and now. Question. Does this aspiration somehow neutralize thoughts about the future? Answer. I want this future to be embodied now, on the spot, here. This is my future. From Cab TV's Kabbalah Express, November 6, 2020. Who will have to pay the bills? Question. There is speculation that future generations will pay for the coronavirus. In addition to debt, we leave them two huge problems, looking after us, when our pensions are left without funding and solving the problems of climate change, which we did not solve and passed on to them. On top of that, we have limited investments in their health and education. In short, the next generation will feel bad. We have robbed our children and grandchildren. But in principle, I still keep thinking about my children and grandchildren. Why does a person suddenly become disconnected from this? They will live in some kind of environmentally dirty, broken world, with a supply of nuclear weapons, whatever you want. We do not even think about what kind of future we have arranged for them. Answer, nobody thinks that he leaves it to his descendants. Why should I think about it? This is natural for a person. Question. To not think about future generations? Answer. No. This is his real face, Homo sapiens. Knowing man. Question. Is this what intelligence is about, to think only of yourself? Answer. Of course. To snatch for yourself as much as possible. I live while I am alive. That is it, nothing else. After us, the deluge. We can do nothing with our nature, it is higher than us. Nothing. There is no natural desire in us, to do something with ourselves for the sake of our descendants. We know that we are putting them right under nuclear bombs, climate problems, whatever. Question. How does one start a dialogue with nature so that it gives us a feeling of both guilt and responsibility that we must do something for future generations? Answer, this can only be done through the realization of the evil of our nature and the way to get out of it. Is there still a way out? But humanity is not suffering enough to seek this way out. Question, but what is the solution? Answer, only dissemination of Kabbalah, which talks about how to correct human nature, reveals all the ignominy, all the improbability of this nature, its horror. It reveals the emptiness in a person, so that he realizes that he needs to fill it. Question. What is this emptiness revealed in? Answer. In hopelessness. Question. Is there no future? Does my nature allow me no future? Answer. It will not allow you anything. A man is the most terrible creature. Question. Then why did the Creator create us, in this way? Answer. In order for us to realize our evil and correct it, to ask Him for correction. And then we will become participants in our new, spiritual development. Question. If He simply did it without our request, then we would receive everything simply for free and would not appreciate it? And here we do have to appreciate it. Answer, we should achieve it. And then we will feel that we received the opportunity to work with this new sensation, with these new forces. People should know this. People should understand that they are faced with a very serious task to correct their own nature. We can do this. From CAPTV's News with Dr. Michael Leitman, September 7, 2020.